On this episode of Baseball Barbiecast, we discuss Shohei Ohtani. Does he take too much time warming up after spending time as a hitter? We're not so sure. We also have a new round of City Connect uniforms that we are, of course, going to review and rank. And it's Friday, so we give you another edition of The Good, The Bad, The Ugly. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbiecast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbiecast, the only baseball podcast in the world thankful that baseball teams are finally connecting to their cities through their jerseys. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And for so long now, I've been saying, I wish this uniform reminded me of the place that this team plays.
Well, now it is no longer something you have to worry about, because here we are again for the sixth year in a row with another round of City Connect uniforms. And we are going to talk about them later on in this Friday edition of Baseball Barbiecast. But before we get to that, we got a little Ohtani chatter to get to, and that is our opener.
I can't believe it. The baseball podcast is beginning with Shohei Ohtani. What a surprise. So here's the deal, friends. I just spent a week, 6 days, whatever, around the Los Angeles Dodgers. Three games here in Washington, D.C., three games in Toronto. And as I flew home the other night and crawled into bed, I couldn't stop thinking about the Ohtani of it all. And I understand how fans at times feel inundated and overstimulated with Ohtani chatter and Ohtani content. Ohtani-tent? Nice. Is this something? But yet, it is all so big and so grand in the world of Shohei that I felt compelled to talk about it here on the show. Jordan, there are many different places we can start here. I do think the most kind of tangible, like, news peg or thing that happened is Ohtani getting more time to warm up as a pitcher after he hits. And I think that is a good entryway into some of the things I want to get off my chest.
Yeah, I mean, that in and of itself is not and should not be news. You know, this is not the first time that this has happened. However, because of a question from some hack journalist in Toronto after the game on Wednesday, we have to go ahead and talk about this. And by hack journalist, I mean you, Jake Mintz, asking a very reasonable question to Dodgers manager Dave Roberts. If you were watching the game on Wednesday, the series finale between the Blue Jays and Dodgers, that the Blue Jays did win, snapping their six-game losing streak, Ohtani pitched that game. He was okay. He was not awesome. He was not bad. But the moment that you were asking about was not necessarily anything involving Shohei's performance, but the very, very beginning of the game. I believe it was the first inning, right? Where if you were watching on the Blue Jays broadcast, you could see that Ohtani, as he was warming up for the bottom of the first after being on base in the top of the first, he was taking some time.
Because he hits.
And the broadcast, because he hits. Yeah, that's the thing he does. The broadcast showed a couple shots. Now, Dan Shulman, who's the best, he was talking about it and kind of narrating over a time when normally the inning would have started already. But the two things you really see in the broadcast are George Springer walking up to the umpire and kind of asking something. And then you see Dave Roberts looking very agitated. Like, he really did look quite angry in this moment.
And that is why,
but it was hard to tell exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Let me be clear. That is why I asked the question to Dave. I was not interested in, like, the fairness of this, of should Ohtani get more time? I was like, Dave, you looked really pissed off. What was that about? I kind of had a feeling that the other people that were around the Dodgers either didn't see that moment because they were, you know, watching the game in front of them, or were watching the Dodgers broadcast alongside the game. I happen to have the Blue Jays broadcast up because I didn't switch over to the Dodgers because the home team is what just pops up, right, on MLB TV. And so I didn't know if anyone else around had seen it. And so that's why I feel compelled to ask it. And Dave did, his answer was, like, totally fine, in my opinion.
It was. I totally agree. However, such is baseball media in 2026, very specific lines of his answer were quote tweeted and put out there with the clip, which included his whole answer. But I do think that the specific lines within there that were kind of blasted everywhere is what stood out to people. But let's give his whole answer. Now, again, what we are talking about is how much time Shohei Ohtani has to warm up, because with the pitch clock, certain pitcher or everybody else basically has an amount of time that they have to be ready for in terms for the inning to begin. I believe, yeah. By the way, before we get to Dave's answer, I have to imagine that if you're George Springer, and multiple sources who have asked around about this since have said from some reporting saying that George Springer was not complaining. I understand this perspective from not just curious, but, and maybe this is me reading too much into it. It's also important for the batter to know when he needs to be in the batter's box so that he's not penalized. So like if the time is going to change for Ohtani, the batter also has to understand the rhythm and the expectation of when he needs to be ready as well. And I would imagine so that he doesn't get an automatic strike. So I would imagine if you're Springer, you're the first guy leading off, you want to know whatever the clock says, you want to know how much time you also have to be ready. So let me just mention that. But this is what Dave Roberts said. Quote, just talking about, he's referring, because this was something that came up during the World Series as well. Roberts says, quote, just talking about the World Series, I think they were a little frustrated about how long Shohei takes in between innings. But if he's on the bases, there's got to be some grace, which the umpires are trying to give him. Yeah, if you're on the other side, you're trying to rush him as much as possible and treat him like any other pitcher. But the truth is that he's different, but I understand their gripe. So this answer does not convey a level of animosity or agita, which, again, based on the broadcast clip, did seem like he was frustrated. So he's deciding in this answer to tone it down and be, and on, if you read the whole thing, he's saying like, I get it, but this is Ohtani. I think that's a totally reasonable answer. However, the quote, he's different and there has to be some grace, makes it sound like, if you don't watch the whole clip, that Roberts is like, you got, sorry, this guy's more special than everybody else, which by the way, he is. But, you know, that was, I think, taken out and read as like, this is a ridiculous answer. And I didn't really understand that.
I think the key point to this conversation is that Ohtani is not getting extra time. He is getting extra time compared to the other pitchers, but he is not getting extra time compared to when pitchers hit. So for those of you who are 4-3 years old, there was once a time when the pitchers in the National League hit. And if a pitcher was on base or finished the inning as a hitter, the umpires would give that pitcher more time to get themselves ready. That was standard. Ohtani, being the only pitcher now that hits, in my opinion, is entitled to that same standard. Do you agree with this opinion?
Yes. Yes, I do.
That's it. Like, what is the argument against it? Like, if you're pissed off that Ohtani is getting what you see as extra time, you're saying, oh, well, he needs to play within the rules of the sport, of the expectations within the sport. But like, he is a different category. He is being treated differently because he is quite literally doing something that no one else is doing, right? From just like a positional, you know, structure standpoint. And I don't think that it is egregious for him to be getting, you know, additional time to get his heart rate down before he goes out to pitch.
Yeah, and like you said, I just think that historical precedent is really all that I need to know. I know that with the pitch clock now, which is a good thing, we are all conditioned for the between innings and just the whole rhythm of the game to feel a lot faster. And so when things do slow down, this applies to a lot of other things, whether it's a replay review, whether it's like now when things slow the action down in baseball, we notice it and are like, what is taking so long? And in the World Series, there were some cases where it took, I think, much longer than what it did the other day. And that was, there were some weird moments like that where it was a little strange. Now, that's not me saying like, okay, they should punish him. This is unfair. Because, again, the dude is trying to do something that no one else is doing. And also, like, what do you want him to, do you think that it's unfair because you're allowing him to catch his breath, whereas you shouldn't. And the people responding and saying, you chose this life, you have to deal with the rigors of it. It's like, yeah, well, he already is doing that. It's very clear that Ohtani, if you saw it in game seven, and we even saw it the other day, and then he admits afterwards, I'm tired. This is hard. This is not something that anyone else is doing.
So
I understand that. I don't expect Blue Jays fans to suddenly open their heart and love him, but yeah, I don't really understand this as a discourse, to be honest.
What is frustrating, I would imagine, is that there's no like hard and fast line in the sand where it's like, oh yeah, like we'll just give him an extra this amount of time. You know, it feels like if to end this debate, you would just say, oh, Ohtani gets 30 extra seconds. You just write it. A pitcher that was on base during the previous inning is allotted 30 extra seconds of warm-up time. And then it's like, okay, it's in the rule book. We've fudged the rules for Ohtani before. I don't think that would be the end of the world. The other things Ohtani-related that have been on my mind, I kind of want to get your take on this, Jordan. You were around for the first three games of this trip. And the coverage of Shohei Ohtani, covering him, being around him, writing about him, reporting on him, is both unbelievably easy and exhaustingly difficult. Because when it comes to what you're actually writing, I'm not trying to paint everybody's boss with a broad brush, and we love our boss here at Yahoo, but like, you don't have to do that much, you know? Like, you can get to 80% of the coverage of Ohtani just by being like, this is incredible. He hit two home runs. He pitched. Here's what he did. Here's how he looked. He's constantly giving us things to think about and talk about and write about, right? And so on that point, on that side, it's easy. The other side, it's difficult because here's the thing, dude. We don't know this guy. We don't know this guy. And having spent 6 days around him, I'm not saying that I feel entitled to know this person. You know, I'm covering him, but I'm like, I'm not given anything. I don't deserve anything. But it is so difficult to write about him just because of the way that he is managed by the Dodgers, by his own choices, by his agency, and obviously the language barrier, which is really significant. But Ohtani speaks once a week to the media after his start, and it's like 6 minutes in English and like five in Japanese, and that's it. And so in my quest, I feel an obligation when we cover people to humanize them, to write about who they are as people, their lives, their desires, their wants, their fears, their goals, their dreams, their struggles. And with Ohtani, I find myself at something of an impasse with that, where because we know so little about him, I find myself projecting things onto him. It's like, that's problematic to some extent because we shouldn't do that. And so I'm just like kind of left as I'm now sitting at home, not unsure on how to cover this person, but sort of confused or frustrated that I can't do more. And not because I, you know, want, not out of like a self-serving way even. Like, I want people to know this guy as a person so that we don't end up calling him machine, unicorn, baseball robot. It's like, no, like Ohtani is a human, but I don't know how to I don't know how to do that. Do you see what I'm saying? I know I'm a little rambly right now, but
yeah. I hear you. I mean, I think in his case, not that he's the only baseball player whose identity is baseball, but when you are trying to accomplish things that no one has ever done and you are doing more baseball than anybody else, you probably have less time to convey any sort of other personality. And that's kind of what the not personality, but like interest focus. There's like literally less time to have those opportunities for even the people closest to him, his teammates, to understand what he's about. But I think the language barrier is still an enormous thing. I think that, of course, the how often he talks, but also just like how he chooses to talk in general, right? I mean, I've even reading, whether it's direct quotes from, maybe we learn a little bit more, I feel like, if you read some of the translations that are of his
in Japanese,
you know, answers he's giving to the Japanese media. And that's no fault to Will Arreton, his interpreter, who's doing his best. And like, again, that's always going to be a challenge. This is not just a Japanese problem as well.
I think it's some fault. I mean, it's like
the word fault is a tough word, but
it's the wrong word.
I mean, in terms of what's because, again, what is his responsibility? Is it Will Arreton's responsibility for us to get to know him? Not necessarily. It would be nice, but that's not, I don't think that's necessarily the job description. He is just trying to communicate, go one way and then back the other way so that this media interaction can take
over
place.
He's as quick as possible.
He's a facilitator. Going beyond that is not the purpose of those interactions. And while obviously what we do is to attempt those things, that creates an inherent challenge, I think. And so Ohtani, as we've seen over the years, has decided to share a very limited amount about his personality. And
which is
part
his
of
right.
maybe some
which
of that
is right.
Yeah.
And like, yeah. and part of that is connected to, you know, how much of a megastar he is back home and the amount of, he wants to be private, and I'm not trying to fault his decision. I'm just saying that decision, that choice, has some consequences in terms of how much we as a society are talking about him, right? I can only write what I'm able to see. I'm not asking him to invite me into his house and like cook me an omelet and cry to me. I'm saying that, like, hey, maybe once every couple of weeks he does a pregame scrum so that we don't feel the need to ask him about the game he just played. You know what I mean? Like, there are ways to do this.
I just want to
like convey this guy in a responsible way. And now let me just say this. There's no incentive for Ohtani to change up what's going on right now because he doesn't need me. And I'm aware of this. He doesn't need me or the people covering the Dodgers or whatever for him to be happy, for him to be successful, for him to make money, for him to be this. He doesn't need to be interesting because what he has been is clearly working, right? And so there's no reason to switch it up. There's only risk. There is little reward, right?
Yes.
And I think this is related now. And the sliding doors moment, obviously, is the Ipe Mizuhara scandal that happens when he first comes to the Dodgers. If that doesn't happen, do you think Ohtani takes on a more interactive, more public-facing persona? I know he wasn't necessarily like that with the Angels, but the superstardom has leveled up since he went to the Dodgers, certainly. And that dynamic started off could not have started worse, right? With what happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you make the point, which is certainly where we stand, which is right. Yes. The risk reward is clear. We understand why he's choosing to handle it this way. But I think the thing I'll just go back to maybe reemphasize is when you describe that timeline of him speaking roughly once a week. That's pretty standard.
After his start.
And so if the times that he is speaking is limited to these extremely specific circumstances at a certain infrequent intervals, there is no time for any amount of additional questions about him. You could do it, but it's in the moment, whether it's in spring training because he just threw a bullpen, whether he just made his start, it is always about what just happened on the field, how he is physically feeling, and what his expectations are the next time. Because what he is doing on the field is singular. And so that is enough, and that is what the focus is in those 10-minute sessions.
And that is the responsibility of the people that cover him every day. And I'm not trying to fault our pals, you know, like Jack Harris at the California Post or Maddie Lee, who's now at the LA Times. Like, these people are trying to cover him on a day-to-day basis. And so, like, they're not incentivized to ask these bigger picture things, nor necessarily, like, is it fruitful to do so? Because the answer is they don't get back in that moment. Like, the other day, Ohtani, they lose, right? The Dodgers lose in kind of brutal fashion. Otani's not very good. I would love to, like, I wanted to ask a question I wrote down in my notebook. How does Otani go about fueling himself, caffeine, food, hydration on a start day different than a non-start day, right? Like, is he eating more? Is he drinking more coffee? How is he preparing? What does he do the day before? I don't know. But I'm not going to ask that after he just looked blah and the Dodgers lost, you know? And I'm not going to cut the line in front of the people who are around him every day, because I think it's very important as someone who, like, parachutes in to not cut the line, if that makes sense.
Well, so, yeah, there you go. And that's you know, how you end up where you end up, right? And it is interesting. Right. It's an interesting dynamic.
Now, again, I want to be very clear. I don't feel like he owes us or me anything. That's not the relationship. And I'm not angry about this. Don't put it in the newspaper that I was angry. I'm not angry about this, but I just am trying to understand why the coverage of Otani is what it is, has gotten to what it's gotten to, where we don't know that much, where that is a choice from his camp. And I think that it is unfortunate, it is understandable, and I think, above all, it is very interesting.
Yeah, and I guess my only pushback would be that in some ways we have made progress, that's a weird way to phrase it, since he's joined the Dodgers. I think that the fact that we know he's got a wife and kid and dog and like these – Anaheim, man, we sure really didn't have anything. And so I think when you recognize that he's going to be around for a while longer, then I think there's a decent chance that some more stuff comes out. But I think also that it's really about that dynamic of how infrequently he talks. There's no room. It's the opposite of why we do get to know managers in a lot of respects, because they have to talk twice a day. And there's just room, natural room as human interaction, where even after the scrum ends, you're just like, hey, what's up? Will you watch any thing on Netflix lately? You know, like those interactions are impossible, both because of the language barrier in our case, but also because of how infrequently he's even standing there available compared to literally sure every other player in the sport, right? And so that yeah is and the so difference. What you end he up is with on the end of the spectrum.
I don't, yeah, it's like what you end up with is just surface level stuff. It's like, hey, why is this so surface level? It's because I'm not, you know, we're not getting deeper than that. I don't know. I've just been crushing a lot of old timey long form sports magazine pieces recently. And like, I read those and I'm like, no one will ever do this with Otani. Like, it's just impossible, which is unfortunate, well, but it is we'll also see understandable. And that's the modern world. That's the modern game. And I think that thankfully what he is doing on the field is compelling, unique, and singular enough that it is interesting on its own. Clearly it is interesting on its own because he is the biggest star in the sport, one of the biggest stars in the world. He has changed our game for the better. And for that, I'm genuinely thankful. But I just thought that this was kind of an interesting discussion topic to open the show with, something that I, again, like all the words that just came out of my mouth are the first time they've come out of my mouth. So I'm just trying to like convey a thing that is not fully formed. And so for the listeners and for you, thank you for slogging through my word soup.
And I would also say that I'm curious how the average fan, Dodgers fan, non-Dodgers fan, Otani super fan, Otani skeptic, Otani skeptic's a funny word for Otani, Otani hater, neutral, Otani hater. If you're any of those things and you're someone who consumes this content, of course, we're tasked with covering the sport, but as someone who, like, do you care? Is this something that bothers you the way that it bothers Jake? And it's, again, I would understand it both ways. So I would love to hear from people about whether that is something that is a limiting factor and if that's something they still crave, or if they just look at what he's doing on the field and they're like, that's enough for me. That's pretty freaking cool. Because I would totally understand that if that was your perspective as well. So let us know.
Yeah.
BaseballBarbacast@gmail.com. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, let's talk jerseys. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It is time to look at the latest round of City Connect uniforms. This has become a regular occurrence over the last five seasons. 2021, I guess, was the first time we were introduced to these special edition uniforms. Now, there are a lot of caveats I think we need to say before we start presenting our very strong and deeply rooted beliefs in the quality of these uniforms. But 2021, we get the first round of them. There basically was like teams have introduced them in the years since. I think the first year, 2021, we got the D-backs and Giants and Marlins and Red Sox, White Sox, Dodgers and Cubs. And we got another round in 22, another round in 23. What is interesting about this latest round, and this was true the last couple of years as well, is now we're on the second generation of City Connect. So early on, it was like, man, what's that team City Connect going to look like? Now it's, okay, what are they going to come up with that is different than last time? Or in some cases, as we will get to, quite similar to the ones that they did last time with some minor tweaks. And I will say that the other thing to note here before we get started is, as we've pointed out every time we do this, there are only two teams that do not have City Connect uniforms for very different reasons. If you want to remind our listeners who those two teams are, Jay.
The New York Yankees and the Yolo County Sacramento A's. Why do the A's not have one? They are not connected to a city. Why don't the Yankees have one? Because they don't want one, because they think they're more important than the rest of us. I think that's it. That's it. Who gets one first? Definitely the A's. The A's will get one when they move to Vegas. They'll do like a night. It'll be like a nightlife thing. It'll be like black and it'll have like gold tint on it. Go ahead. Yeah.
It is also worth noting that they did add Sacramento jerseys this year, which does not qualify as City Connect, but is at least a temporary acknowledgement that they are no longer playing in Oakland and they are playing in a new city. So, again, I wish those said Yolo County, but we'll take it.
The A's should have had City Contempt jerseys when they were in Oakland. City Contempts.
Oh, there's John Fisher rolling down the rocking his City Contempt.
It's just an A's jersey, but it says I hate over Oakland. City Contempt.
And the last thing to mention, too, is there are only three teams left that have not had a second one now, which I think is interesting. The Cubs, who introduced their Wrigleyville uniforms in 2021, seem to be moving away from City Connects. They don't wear those, and they seem to have like these other alternates that I guess function as a City Connect, but they're not calling them official City Connect, so that's a little bit weird. The Angels and Mariners, Angels who introduced their one in 2022, Banger. And then the Mariners in 2023. I think we like both of those. I know I like both of them a good amount, but those two teams still have their own. So why they haven't come up with a new one while the 27 or 25 other teams have? Who knows? Whatever. Okay. So which teams gave us their latest editions this time?
One last big picture thought here from Jake Mintz. This is all very good. Okay. We are not necessarily fashionistas. Me certainly more than you. When it comes to uniforms, we are sartorially mid. However, I think that this exercise has zero downside, because if the City Connect uniforms suck, it's funny. And if they're good, it's good. And so I am so happy that we have this, that we have implemented this. It is interesting to think about. It is interesting to talk about. I know the purpose of it is for the league to sell more stuff, but you know, such is capitalism. But I think it's good. Like, I have this, none of this makes me mad, you know? And the last thing I'll point out here,
totally,
Jordan,
agree,
is that we have new uniforms from the Royals, Pirates, Reds, Padres, Rangers, Brewers, Orioles, and Braves. Uniforms that I have not looked at yet. I was in Toronto, got back late the other night, woke up yesterday morning around like 10:30 to multiple texts from people being like, these City Connects are weird. These are crazy. I was like, you know what? I'm not going to look at them. I'm going to reveal them to myself live on the show. Now, I've seen dribs and drabs. I've seen parts of parts. But as far as like zooming in on stuff, this is new for me.
Yes. And before we get started here, I think that the other thing I just want to make sure I say before we have these conversations and judge them and rank them and tell us which ones are great and which ones are bad. The other funniest part about to me as someone who isn't as passionate about uniforms, when these come out, you will find for most of these, just as many people being like, these are the greatest uniforms ever. This is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Like, it is a great, great split. And it's just that split judgment. And I think that you having not seen them is a good version of you being able to just see them and react instantly. That said, it is also worth acknowledging that most of these, all of them, come with a backstory that we are only going to supply a fraction of. And in a lot of these cases, I do encourage people to go read about some of the very intricate details behind some of these. However, at the end of the day, most people aren't going to do that. They're going to look at the uniforms and decide whether they are cool or not. And so it's great to have the lore, and I respect the teams that put in real effort to kind of draw these connections. And that's true with the past editions, and that's true with these ones. But at the end of the day, you're going to run out there on the ball field, and most people will not have read any of those things. And so you do still want it to look good. And so I think that is probably how you are going to judge them. After the pod, I'm sure you'll go read about them and be like, oh, actually, that's cooler than I realized. Or, oh, actually, that's not as cool as I realized. There's my caveat. All right, let's get into it. I guess we're going in no particular order. So why don't you go ahead and click on the Kansas City Royals, and I will read. I'm just going to read the couple sentence description on the main MLB.com story. So here we have the Kansas City Royals. This is the description. Quote, the city's official City of Fountains logo inspired a fuchsia to blue gradient that highlights Kansas City's iconic waterways. A new twist on the R logo pays homage to the team's original 1969 mark, and a heart logo reflects Kansas City's placement in the country's heartland. What do you think?
This is the bisexual flag.
Yep.
Has that been pointed out, this colorway?
Yeah, you're definitely not the first person to tweet that 100,000 times. So that's true.
I got no beef
with that.
I like it. It looks great.
Make sure we follow that up there. You said that first.
Just, yeah, I'm not saying,
oh my God.
yuck. The bisexual flag. No, this looks a lot like the bisexual flag, which is a very nice looking flag. And these uniforms really good. I like the colors are nice. I like that they went with this aggressive colorway, and it's the white is the base of it. I think the cap is very cool, how it's supposed to look like fountains and a crown at the same time. These are a big win for me.
I mostly agree. I think I like the crown. I think I would have liked the R on the hat more, but these are solid. These are in the upper half for me, for sure. They're also it's a different colors than the original editions that also leaned heavily into the fountains. I do like these more than those, but it's also pretty similar. So I don't, they didn't why jump fuchsia? Too far out from what they were already doing. Why they went with these colors exactly, I guess I'll have to read more about that. So I'm not sure.
Okay.
Again, you're going to ask me a lot of questions that I'm probably not going to have answers to. So sorry, that makes me look bad. Then I apologize. Let's go to the Pittsburgh Pirates. Take a look at the Pittsburgh Pirates. Last time, the Pirates had one that was really leaning into the bridges. However, now they are leaning into the Pirates. From MLB.com, the Pirate style word mark on the chest draws inspiration from the city's three sister bridges across the Allegheny River. While red accents and Jolly Roger elements bring a splash of color to the black and gold backbone that is elemental to Pittsburgh sports tradition.
Why are they the Pirates, man? I never really thought that hard about this, that Pirates tend to be an open ocean, and Pittsburgh
That's
is
definitely true.
Certainly not an open ocean city. So leaning into the Pirates does not really feel like they're leaning into the city. I will say, however, even though these look a little bit like a travel ball uniform, these are going to sell like hotcakes. These are perfect for the kids. I don't love the black pants, but the font is if you had to design a font to go in a baseball uniform to like sell jerseys to 8-year olds, like this is 10 out of 10.
I'm a huge sucker for the old Pirates logo that looks like a pirate. And so I'm glad that they brought that back.
With the bandana.
Even if it is a weird way to connect. Yeah, with the bandana. I love that. I wish that that logo was still the same normal color as opposed to the whole hat being yellow, which looks a little strange. But as you mentioned, these things are going to sell ridiculously well in Pittsburgh, leaning into the black and gold with a little bit of a twist. And as AT on Twitter at Baseball World pointed out, that the Connor Griffin version of these is already sold out in every size.
Yeah. Every size.
Which is every size. Yeah. So I don't know how quickly they're going to restock those, but that is very predictable. And I like these. I think I'm a little bit higher on these than from what I've seen a lot of the other people have put. But I'm a sucker for just kind of these colors and the Pirates motif. So, and I like these more than the last ones. So, okay. So Pirates. Sounds like you like the Royals more. Let's go to the Cincinnati Reds. The Cincinnati Reds. Let's read their description. Quote, with a nod to the vest-style jersey the Reds last wore more than two decades ago, pinstripes returned to the fore in a tone-on-tone style. A sleeve graphic features the Tyler Davidson fountain, which begins flowing each year around opening day. This C is the one they basically introduced with the last City Connects, but those were all black. Yeah. And now we're going red on red on red on red. I like these more than the last ones, but I'm still not all the way there. What do you think?
Love these. Love these. They're the Reds, dude. They're literally called the Reds. Right. Like
for
they,
sure.
They are red. Like they should be red. And this is incredibly red. And they're way better than the last ones, which I am excited to see not be around anymore. But great. This is wonderful. I like this.
Let's go to the San Diego Padres. And I believe this was the one that you have already seen a bit of watching our man Randy Vasquez last night. But I will read the description on MLB.com. Quote, celebrating San Diego's bi-national culture with a focus on Dia de los Muertos. The design features a chest word mark reflective of a sunset, a La Catrina sleeve patch, marigold pattern trim, bone-colored hat and pants, and a nod to Mexican folk art, and a papal picado jock tag. Okay. So is my thing.
A papal picado jock tag? No.
Not a combination of words I have ever spoken, not just into a microphone, but in my life.
Okay.
What do you think?
They're not as good as the other ones. I mean, I'm sure everyone's saying that. The other ones were just singular. They were great. These are very cool. I like that they take into account the orange from Padres uniforms past, the blue and navy. It is a nod to that. And it is funny to me, I saw some tweets that were like, the Padres were just like, let's do Mexico, which, great. Like, cool. They did. Oh my God, I see the patch now. This is awesome.
So the patch is awesome. One note about just the jersey itself, and then I'll get to a part that I think you probably haven't really seen or noticed yet because you haven't watched like the video and stuff. My biggest beef with the jersey is that they didn't change the font of the San Diego from the last one. And I don't understand why they didn't do that. I like the new colors. I really like the last ones too, to be clear. But there was another font, especially on the patch. Like, I don't know why they just didn't go with that. So I didn't totally understand that.
Yeah.
That said, leaning into the Day of the Dead celebration and tradition that is, of course, very popular in Mexico is very interesting. And if you do watch the video that the Padres put out, every team except for the Braves put out a hype video for their uniform, which we could speculate on in a second. However, this is just a really interesting choice. In the video, they basically are showing some of the most important figures in Padres history who passed away at a very young age. Of course, Peter Seidler, of course, Tony Gwynn, of course, Ken Caminiti. And so they're kind of using this as inspiration of like, we are honoring and celebrating those we've lost. And I know there's a lot else that goes into the traditions of the Day of the Dead that are more nuanced and more interesting that I'm not going to speak on as someone that's not a holiday. Of course, I grew up that meant a lot to me, but reading more about that history, like it is a lot more specific than just like we're, you know, embracing our Mexican culture, which is also great. There's nothing wrong with that. Of course, being in San Diego, but I was really compelled and kind of moved by that video of all the hype videos. Like it was, It was, I think, the most interesting motif that I think a lot of people maybe missed by just some of the base level photos. So I thought that was really interesting. Yeah.
I'm scrolling through this video now. Like the pictures of these deceased Padre legends on the altar.
Yeah.
Is like deep. Like I wasn't expecting such weight. Wow.
And that's the thing. So that is a clear, a pretty intense and interesting choice by the Padres. And as you can tell, different teams kind of choose to complete this assignment in different ways, I guess is the best way to put it. But I like these a lot. I wish they had changed the font on the front, but yeah.
Pretty good. These are good. And the Padres logo, the La Cantina logo on the sleeve, I've never heard the way. What was the word you used? Jock patch? I've never heard that.
Jock tag.
Jock tag? I've never heard that word. Yeah. That like sticker thing, that is really, really cool. Let's move on to the next one.
Let's go to the Texas Rangers. Again, reading from MLB.com. Quote, the Rangers also celebrate Mexican heritage near the border with cochineal, not a word I know, cochineal red anchors and a Tejas word mark across the chest, as well as a charro embossed belt and mariachi inspired fill patterns. This one is, I mean, listen, if bad. You're going to lean into just the Mexican heritage Tejas, that's fine. Again, if we're focused on the aesthetics, this is not going to be the one that wins any of the rankings because it looks like they needed to come up with something the day before and said, oh, well, we could just lean into this. The smaller details on the side and the piping, that's fine. But again, what's the first thing you see? And you're like, that's all you got? And I think in that sense, I think people are kind of disappointed.
Here's the thing. They actually look all right. They look pretty simple, which compared to the old Texas ones.
I was going to say, this is the biggest swerve away from the original edition by far, right? I mean, the other ones were pretty wacky. And I know those were some of the most divisive ones that we've had. So I do give them credit for doing something totally different with this next one.
There is also something to be said about the Rangers doing the Tejas jersey and positioning themselves as like a team for different types of people, but then the whole team is white basically, and they have a statue in the stadium of a very problematic figure from the state's past. And so to me, I understand what they're trying to do, and I know that the organization itself, like there is not everyone in the organization agrees with all the decisions that the organization has made, whether that's like to not have a pride night or to throw that statue in there, whatever. The upshot is like, I think because of that, it kind of misses the mark a little bit with me. It looks, you know what it kind of looks like? Kind of looks like a JUCO jersey. And I think I like that.
I've never really thought about what specifically a junior college baseball jersey looks like. Maybe like the T, like the hat, kind of
the hat.
Like maybe it's something about the hat and the logo. But yeah, I mean, the reality is the Rangers are like as the least inclusionary franchise we have. The evidence of that is
by a lot,
unfortunately, all over the place, and that is disappointing. But as you mentioned, that's not necessarily who's involved in these designs, and we're not going to
do the go. The
it's
Nimmo
still a good
Tejas
thing to celebrate
jersey.
Heritage like that, but yeah. So in that sense, it's
the Brandon kind of Nimmo Tejas jersey is very funny.
Yeah. So there's an incongruency there, but I guess that's a lot of our life in 2026.
I think this looks good. I think this looks good. I'm actually kind of high on this from an aesthetic standpoint. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right. Three more. Let's go to the Milwaukee Brewers. Milwaukee Brewers. Okay. Wisco. Ooh. Do people say Wisco? I guess we're going to find out. Here we go.
I hope they do.
From MLB.com. Code. Honoring the Brew Crew's role, not just as Milwaukee's team, but Wisconsin's team. A water-toned bass and cream accent evoke the Badger State's lakes, shores, and bluffs. And a gradient word mark is inspired by the state's beautiful summer sunsets. The Wisco lettering on the chest, state motto on the collar, and redesigned barrel man sleeve patch all serve to celebrate the team's history and Wisconsin's rich heritage.
Yeah.
Okay. Tune in for Jake's scorching reactions to seeing the City Connects for the first time. This is like the opposite of like a YouTube thumbnail where it's someone like, oh my, whoa, can you believe they put Wisco on a jersey?
I think I need to dig into the details. I like the shoulder braid, how it looks like wheat. I like that.
Oh.
I like the barrel man is cool. I think there's probably one too many color going on here. I don't love the shade of blue that they used. I think that the word mark, like the letters on the front look a little bit cartoonish almost. I love this video I'm now seeing of Packers QB Jordan Love pulling one of these out of a cooler, like a beer cooler. I think that's fun.
The Brewers City Connect hype video is essentially just a Wisconsin tourism. There's not even it's hard to even distinguish this from, which I guess point. But we're showing it right now on YouTube. You can go watch it. It really is just a visit Wisconsin jersey, which is fine. Like, that is one way to go about doing this. You're connecting to your place, and I get that.
I get it.
But it really is, and like I mentioned, that these teams are just going about this in very different ways, which is not a bad thing.
You do not see a baseball player until the 48-second mark of this video.
Yeah.
It's just fishes, lakes, and bluffs, I guess.
Good people of Wisconsin, truly tell me, like, is Wisco something you're saying regularly? Is that how you are identifying yourself? I hope so. I would assume that is more standard than I have ever realized in my life, which, you know, shame on me as now a Midwesterner.
Again, Wisconsin in the summer, Milwaukee in the summer is as good as this country gets. So I appreciate them tipping their cap to that.
To me, I would just do more barrel man all the time. That dude is undefeated.
Make the whole plane out of barrel man.
I'm glad that he's on the sleeve, but we could do even more. Okay, two more. Your Baltimore Orioles. This is a big one. This is one of the boldest ones we have.
These bang.
Yeah, these are fantastic. Again, reading from MLB.com. Quote. The O's threw it way back to the 1890s Baltimore Baseball Club for inspiration for the old school B on the cap. And the uniform design pays tribute to Camden Yards with motifs that include the brass home run plaques, the wrought iron scoreboard clock. The Oriole bird sits perched atop the B more lettering. I love these.
Cap is the like on the seats. Like, that's the logo that's like on the Camden Yards on the side of the rows, right?
I believe so, which again is a super duper throwback. And I'm just, you know, I'm a sucker for the Oriole bird, leaning into the bird, but like the real bird, not the cartoon bird. Having more of the real birds, and the little details on this one are just terrific. Having the clock on there, having those kind of those brass home run plaques on there where it, you know, the home runs that land out on Utah Street, like it's great. You do have to kind of get over seeing like "Be More" on the front, which is obviously not a word. it's like seeing something that is an abbreviation is unusual, right?
Like Wisco.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean yes, but because it's B more. There aren't the words five that letters. Start with B. Yeah, it's this looks a little bit more like, oh, what is that? And then you're like, okay, yes, B more. So I like these a lot. Other than that, I think these are probably in the top two or three for me.
These are awesome. The hats on their own are a little weird, I think. Like if you're just wearing the hat, the sure. orange and green together is it's a little Miami, University of Miami. But I love these. Wow. They did great job. Wow.
Yeah. Very good work. And finally, the Braves of Atlanta. Let's read about the Braves of Atlanta. Where is this? As we pull it up here.
They have phoned it in.
Yep. All right. Quote, the powder blue uniforms of the 1980s were the inspiration for a modernized design with red piping, an updated Atlanta script, and ATL block letter sleeve patch. The team's contemporary color scheme is paired with the throwback style. Okay. Look, this is the same thing as last time. Because they can.
Why are they phoning
it? And because the old... These are throwbacks. It's the same thing that they did last time. They look good. They're really cool.
They look great.
This is not a bold redesign. You are not coming up with anything remotely creative or nuanced. Because again, it's not that we should understand all of it at first, but it should still feel like you tried to do something different. And this is just not what happened. It just didn't happen here. So it doesn't look bad. It looks great, but I don't want to over-reward it because I don't think that they really completed the assignment.
They didn't even begin the assignment. Like, right. Here's the thing, dude. If Atlanta was this boring place with no cultural touchstones and the Braves wanted to nod to their history, instead, I'd be like, okay. You're in Atlanta. Like, dude, there's so much to draw from, and yet they're just phoning it in from a creative standpoint. Like, the lettering across the chest is the exact same lettering that they had on jerseys in the 80s, I believe. Like, it's just the exact same. The logo on the hat is the exact same. There's no new actual design being done here. I guess there's this ATL sleeve patch that looks pretty sweet. Like, that's the best part of this.
Sure. But otherwise, this is a throwback uniform. I'm sorry. It is not a different – it is not an alt. It is not a City Connect. It is not a new jersey, a new uniform, a fresh concept. No. That is not what this is. And so, frankly, that by itself, on the premise of the whole – exercise and this entire line of uniforms makes me want to rank it last. It does not look worse. I think it looks cooler. I would rather wear this than some of the other ones here if I was a Braves fan or a casual fan. It looks really cool. But if we're grading it on going for it and really trying something different with real thought behind it, this is behind the other ones and it's not even close. But with all that said, I will let you go ahead and do your rankings, and I will go ahead and try to do mine before we take a break.
Mm. Okay, so we've got eight.
Yep.
I'm looking for a picture of all eight in the same place. I think overall, I'm going to put the O's at one.
Okay.
I think that's pretty easy. I will put the Braves at eight. And so in between that, I'm going to go fast, and I will go Orioles, Royals, Padres, Pirates, Reds, Brewers, Rangers, Braves.
I am with you at the bottom. I think I'm going to go Orioles, Padres, Pirates, Royals, Reds, Rangers, Brewers, Braves.
Are you saying that you are against the bisexual community?
No, that is not what I'm saying. But
sounds like it.
That was good. That was a nice follow-up question.
Gotcha.
Some good journalism from Jake Mintz. That is what he's got to ask, folks. Let us know, because everyone has feelings about these. So let us know yours. Baseball.
Let us know if you like the jerseys. Don't let us know if you hate the bisexual community. Please don't do that.
We're going to take a break. When we return, the good, the bad, the ugly, and a little bit more. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we get to the good, the bad, the ugly, there is something that we need to talk about.
Jordan, do you think that if you were an owner, and how would you react to your fans chanting "sell the team"?
It's a great question. Do I know that the broadcast is about to show me?
Because that no, might... but you should assume that you should assume that they could.
Hmm. Yeah, this is a tough one. So earlier this week, before the Red Sox won consecutive games against the Milwaukee Brewers, taking the series and getting their season back on track, yeah, they're still 4-8. But that series opener was an absolute slop fest, which included a couple errors and bad pitching and bad hitting, and it was ugly. And John Henry, the owner of the Red Sox, was in attendance for this one as the Red Sox fell to 2-8. And as there were, I believe, earlier this season already, some audible sell the team chants at Fenway Park. My goodness, how about that? And they happened to show John Henry in his suite during this interaction. And you can see him kind of look around and say, what's going on here? And then he goes, he kind of gives this like flippant like nod of just like, oh, sell the team. That's what they want me to do. They want me to sell the team. When you saw this video, Jake, what emotions went through your mind, heart, soul, as the sell the team discourse that extends beyond baseball, it extends beyond Boston. This is just something that we now have where fans are very upset with their ownership groups and this is a unique one, right? This is not an owner that is not spending any money. Most of the time, we're hearing the Pirates fans and the A's fans and the Guardians and whatever. This is very different. But John Henry has angered Red Sox fans enough. The Red Sox certainly early in the season have angered them enough to inspire them to say this. But what do you make of this response, this unintentionally public response?
It was so cartoonish in its villainy. I think that if you are an owner, the villainy is built in for every single owner in a way where you are richer than everyone in your city. Usually you are separate. You're in this like kingly perch in your box and everything that you're doing as an owner from that point forward is to basically foster goodwill amongst your subjects, right? Is to act as a steward of the team in a way. These people buy teams, one, to make money, and two, to feel loved, right? And three, because they like ball. And I think that Henry is just morphed into this super easy to dislike figure for Red Sox fans. And I think a large part of that has to do with his other sports dealings as part of Fenway Sports Group, a group that owns Liverpool and a group that I believe is in the process of purchasing the Pittsburgh Penguins or bought the as the Pittsburgh Penguins. And I think that fans believe that that means Fenway Sports Group's like money and energy is stretched thin to the point that it is not being focused on the Red Sox. And I think that those criticisms are only amplified by how rarely we see and hear from John Henry and how there's kind of an upper management that speaks for him. And so this all combined for a very unfortunate look for Mr. Henry. My favorite part, Jordan, is that Nesson is the one, New England Sports Network, is the one that threw him on camera. Nesson, 80% of which is owned by Fenway Sports Group. I genuinely hope that whoever made the decision to put John Henry on television at this point still has their job.
Yeah, because there's definitely other circumstances like that where they probably are telling their TV station that they own, like, hey, never show me, ever. There's no reason to ever put me on TV, regardless of whether the team is doing well or doing poorly. But in this case, that's not what happened. And so you had this very unfortunate clip that, just reeks of dismissiveness. But you know what? Let's go most generous, hilarious interpretation ever, where he truly was confused about what was being chanted. And then he just had a human moment of, oh, that's what they're saying. And then he had the second human moment of, oh, but I own the team. Ooh. Awkward. Whoops. That is not what you like to hear. Oh, who should? Who? Yeah. Well, what if he's like, yeah, sell the team. This team stinks. Yeah, oh, my goodness.
You chant anything, it'll catch on.
Wait, hold on. I also just wanted to say, because I've wanted to bring this up every time we do sell the team discourse, and I don't think I have. What we need to normalize is buy the team chants.
I was literally going to say this.
When there's other rich people around. Else.
By the team.
You need to be motivating. I don't know who that would be in Boston's case that people want. Who does the average Red Sox fan want to buy the Red Sox? I'm not sure. But we need to normalize buy the team chants so that we can push. It's not just about this. I know it goes both ways. One has to happen before the other. But we also need someone to want to buy. And I want to encourage those rich folks to buy the team. Buy the team. All right. Let's go to the good, the bad, and the ugly.
One thing good, one thing bad, one thing Dan Ugla from the week that was. I will begin with some golf. It is Masters weekend, the 4 days a year where I remember that golf exists. I'm one of those people, and I'm not embarrassed by it. But the reason I am bringing up the old golf here on this baseball podcast is because we had a golf baseball crossover first pitch at an Arkansas Razorbacks baseball game. A Arkansas student, a 19-year-old by the name of Maria Jose Marin, won the Augusta Women's National Amateur Tournament. Okay. Now, for a long time, women were not allowed in Augusta. And now they are, thank God, because it's 2026. And so they do a women's tournament for the amateurs, and she won, a student. And to celebrate, they had her out to the Razorbacks game to chip the first pitch. They put a little home plate thing of grass right in front of the mound, and they put the catcher behind the dish, and they had Maria Jose Marin chip the golf ball into the catcher's mitt. And she absolutely nails it. Now, I should not be surprised considering this one appears to be very skilled in the sport of golf. I'm not saying like, wow, I didn't think she could do this. It's just the ease with which she throws a literal strike with the golf ball, chipping it. This, if I had done this, Jordan, if you were like, Jake, we need to do this, I would hit it over the stadium. Like, I would hurt someone. There would be injury involved. And so for her to nail this, now I wish there were more people in the stands and they didn't do this on a Tuesday midweek game against Arkansas Little Rock. And they did this for an SEC weekend series. It would have been a lot more hype. But very impressive performance from Maria Jose Marin.
I agree. This was a great video. I totally missed this. And no, I was super impressed. And you know who else is impressed? All the baseball players that play golf. So in that sense, it's a pretty good crossover. I'm sure that there were many players in the dugout being like, yeah, I would not. I would also launch it over the
I can't do that.
Over the backstop. All right, my good this week could just be Sal Stewart, because Sal Stewart, Cincinnati Reds rookie, is hitting 364, 473, 727. This, my goodness. Okay.
Good player.
You want to wonder why it's like this guy's holy crap. Okay, anyway. But let's get more specific here, because Sal Stewart this week was in Miami, his hometown, beating up on the Miami Marlins, hit a couple of home runs. But I want to focus on this tweet from friend of the show, Charlie Goldsmith, who at the beginning of this series tweeted out, Sal Stewart expects 150 to 170 friends and family in Miami for the game today. He's from here. Thanks, Charlie. Thanks for that context. Actually, it'd be so funny if he didn't. If he did not. include he's from here, and people are just like, what? Why? What's going on? Anyway,
here's how I would have written this tweet, Charlie, friend of the program. Miami native Sal Stewart expects 150 to 170 friends and family for the game today. You know, like,
yes,
he's from here is great.
He's from here kills me. However, I want to just pause here and think about the premise. And if you watched any of these Reds Marlins games, I'm not sure it was clear that it was 150 to 170, but they kept showing different sections of Sal Stewart fans when he was getting hits and homers. Like, they would pan to a section that was clearly his high school teammates and friends, and then it was clearly like, okay, there's the Stewart family, and maybe there's the mom side. This was happening. And I just, as someone who had 109 people at my wedding, and I know this is a different circumstance, but I do just think about the idea of, if I was playing in my hometown, I don't even, how many people would I really want to invite that I know and could reasonably get to show up? Like, this is just, okay, there's one, Jake. Yeah, I would invite you. That's good. Your family could come. Great.
My wife.
I just think this, yeah, she's involved. She's invited too. This number is just staggering and hilarious to me, because normally you see like a row or two. And I guess everybody loves Sal Stewart, which I understand. He seems like a great person and a great player. But man, whew, what a family.
It was only accentuated by the reality that loanDepot Park in Miami is not exactly packed all the time.
What percentage of the paid attendance was, you know, rooting for Sal Stewart? I don't know exactly, but I'm in awe of this, the logistics involved here, how many of these he actually personally invited versus just decided, oh yeah, Sal probably wants me to be here. Like, I can't get over this number. It's really something.
So a couple other things about this. I believe Sal Stewart, so he's only 22. I think he'd be a senior in college right now. He graduated high school in 22. So that means he would have graduated college in 26.
Yep.
So I would imagine that a lot of his friends from high school are still in the area. They probably go to college nearby at Miami or Florida State or Florida or FIU or whatever. And so it was relatively easy for them to come on home. And I think that Miami is a place where if you're from there, you tend to stay there. You know, like, it seems like a place you don't flock away from. And so I would imagine that certainly contributed. But 170 is just nuts. And it must include plus ones. That's the other thing, right? I don't think – do you think Sal Stewart, let us know. If after the game they invited all 170 people onto the field – and they mic'd up Sal Stewart, and they said, first and last name, each person. He gets 135, 140.
And maybe we're wrong, and he's close friends with all of these people, or he has 5 bajillion cousins that he got to come out. I'm thinking about the video of Connor Griffin's debut, where it looks like he had 25, 30, maybe 40. And that's for an enormous debut. I understand it's Pittsburgh. It's not a home game, right? That's like the different kind of thing. But man, to your point, right? How many of these people, it's like, oh yeah, I had to have this guy here.
I have a friend like this though. I have a buddy, my buddy Michael, you know, I'll check it with him and I'll be like, what do you got going on this week? And he's like, oh, I got a bachelor party for this guy. And then next weekend, I got a wedding for that guy. And it's like, who are these friends you have? I don't know. These people are made up. But how do you have so much time to have so many friends? Maybe Sal Stewart is just an extrovert to just an outrageous degree.
Personality-wise, that does track. I just am still in awe of just the broader situation. Okay, let's go to the bad. Why don't you start us off, my friend?
The Yankees, the New York Yankees have... By the way, the New York Yankees, who lost a home series to the A's yesterday... The first time that the A's have won a series in Yankee Stadium since 2016. How about that? That is bad for the Yankees, but that is not what I was going to bring up. They DFA'd a reliever by the name of Cade Winquest. Cade Winquest was a Rule 5 pick by the Yankees. I believe they took him from the Cardinals. Jordan will know this.
Yep.
Cade Winquest, impressed in spring training, made the team out of camp. and was on the big league roster of the Yankees for the last 2 weeks and did not get in a game. And then the Yankees DFA'd him yesterday to make room for Luis Gil, who has been in the minors staying ready because the Yankees have only needed four starters to start the year. And Cade Winquest will now either be claimed by another team or return to the Cardinals minor league system. And this is bad because the Yankees not getting this guy in a game to make his major league debut is just so uncool and like unfathomable to me. And there's no way that every single Yankees game has been close enough that they couldn't have gotten him in for an inning to make his debut.
That's the thing. A lot of them were close, but I count at least two or three games where they were either up by a lot or down by enough where it was like, this should be Cade Winquist and not Paul Blackburn again. Specifically because of the Rule 5 situation. This is not that anybody is owed a major league debut. There have been situations in the past where guys get called up because of weird circumstances and they stay on the roster and they don't get in. I remember very vividly the Nationals had one of these in 2021 when they called up a guy named Stephen Fuentes, who was on the roster for 11 days and never got in and never ended up making his major league debut because he immediately got hurt after being sent down. That breaks my heart. But in that case, there was weird stuff going on. COVID call-ups in 21. It was like, is this guy would normally have been here? Rule fives, these, you have to make it all the way through camp. And for him to do enough to do that and then only to get this far and never get in, I think Cade Winquist is good enough that he's going to be in the majors at some point somewhere. But for him to have to go through the emotion, the Rule 5 experience is so unique. And if you do make it to opening day and make the team, that should be the part where it's like, all right, this is the team I'm going to debut with. Sometimes those guys get sent back even after they debut. But in this case, like, come on. I mean, this is just bad, disappointing. I totally agree with that. Also, as you reminded me there, incredible timing that the A's and Yankees were playing this week when the City Connects were being announced. They should have been selling all 28 other City Connects at Yankee Stadium during this series to celebrate the cities that these teams refuse to connect to, at least via uniforms. Anyway, let's go to Minnesota for my bad, where the Tigers suffered the first mop of the season. A mop, to remind everybody, is a four-game sweep. A few years ago, we decided, you know, sweep does not do a four-game situation justice. Let's elevate this to a mop. Four-game series are quite rare with the balanced schedule. However, they do happen. And if you lose all four, that is a mop. And that is what happened to the Detroit Tigers, who have lost five in a row. They are 4-9, the worst record in Major League Baseball, alongside the pathetic Seattle Mariners. And this is just not how this was supposed to go for a Tigers team that had a very strange offseason. But by the end, we were pretty excited of what that pitching staff looked like. And we expressed some skepticism about the offense. But hey, Kevin McGonigal's here and he changes everything. Apparently not, as they rank 29th in home runs. They're about average in some of the other offensive categories, but the pitching has just not been great. Their bullpen is last in walk rate, which is bad. With relievers walking guys, that is a bad combination of just like a bad watch. That is a good way to anger your fan base, is when relievers are walking guys. Mm-hmm. But they're starting, their rotation ERA is 26th as well. So things are not going great for the Detroit Tigers. Getting mopped by a Minnesota Twins team that probably was not expecting to win very much this year is not a good look. But hey, Twins, good for you. I maybe they won't be that bad, and I'll give them some respect there. Go to Ugla. What you got?
Not a lot has been going right for the Red Sox so far this year. I know they've won two in a row, but their new on-base celebration is the best on-base hand signal celebration that I've seen. They will put their hands on their head, or they'll shush the dugout, or they'll like do like a chop with their arms. And it was like, what are they doing? This is a tweet from Pat Brown 954, a Red Sox follower, who tweeted, Cora confirmed on WEEI that the on-base celebration is a result of the classic Roman Anthony TikTok dance. This is a video of Roman Anthony in high school doing like one of those just TikTok dances that the kids do, where they shake their hips and they, you know, roll their bodies. And it is just, it is very embarrassing. It is embarrassing at face for Roman Anthony. Not embarrassing on a deep level, right? It is, kids are kids. They do silly things. It's also a reminder that Roman Anthony, who in this video, like, looks like Roman Anthony does now because it was only, like, you know, 3 or 4 years ago because he's 12. He's not as big. Yes, he's not as ripped. He's not as large. I understand. But you could very much tell it's Roman Anthony. It's really lovely. This is just so funny. It's great stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no video like this for Trevor Story because TikTok, very much not a thing when Trevor Story was in high school or literally anybody else on the team. I guess the app has been around long enough for kind of, but no, this is a fresh situation for Roman Anthony to find himself in. And I agree, this is good, but it is also most certainly ugly. All right, we'll finish
the date
off
on this. So we know, the date on this is, it's this 7/24/2019. So it has been a little bit.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's like closer to middle school, or that's close. That's close. That's like early high school, middle school. My ugly this week, we'll go out to Colorado where, let's just say, clap it up, Colorado Rockies. I know you got walked off Grand Slam last night by the Padres, but sweeping the Astros, Rockies fans are having the time of their lives. They are taking their shirts off in the upper deck and just going nuts. I love it. I'm so happy for the Rockies fans who are enjoying this just like competent start to the season. It's awesome. Like, I don't think this is still a bad baseball team, but just be a normal bad baseball team. Do your best. Have some stuff to cheer about. Sweep a team every once in a while. Make it feel like you're moving towards something, that you're building any semblance of competence. I'm excited to see what the Rockies have done so far. However, my ugla is Astros related. And this comes from friend of the program, Julia Morales, one of our favorite dugout reporters, one of the longest tenured dugout reporters that we have. And Julia posted this series of images.
This is so good.
And she tweeted, asked Christian Vasquez and Jeremy Pena to take a pic with my phone of them in the visitors' bullpen at Coors Field while I interviewed the manager. This is what I got. It is a series of four images that Jeremy Pena and Christian Vasquez delivered. And two of the images are a toilet, the visitors' bullpen toilet, which also includes a pack of Dude Wipes. So that's pretty funny. Really good hospitality there for Coors Field. Two packs. What is the joke here? Hey, Julia, I took a picture of a toilet. Not just one picture of a toilet. Yes. A picture of a toilet with the seat up, and then another picture of the toilet with them like posing with the toilet. I love the simplicity of this. They're like, oh, what would be funny? Oh, let's take a picture of a toilet. I've never seen one of these before.
I mean, it's up my alley. I think this is hilarious.
I do too, but it's like, okay, what is the good? And then for her to be like, yeah, now let's post the selfie with the toilet. The toilet does look quite clean, but I guess it's pregame. So, and then the other two images of them posing with the fountains out there, which is of course the staple of the Coors Field beyond the outfield experience, but just great work all around. If it was just the selfie with the toilet, I don't even know if I would have picked this for ugla, but that it also got a kind of a basic image of like, okay, toilet, and then here's us with the toilet. It's just awesome. It's just so funny and so ugla. So Julia, great work here, I guess, unintentionally.
Now, before we get out of here, I have an Astros related super ugla. This is the first super ugla in podcast history. Jordan, go ahead and click on that link in the document. And you will see an Instagram reel of a Kazakh musician named Dude on the Guitar. I came across this. I was looking for some new music and I really like his stuff. He's got a nice sound. He has fun visuals. And this is his newest song, which is, I'm going to mispronounce this, Barayatr. And in this video, it starts off by him like showing a ring to the camera to like flex on him. And the ring is an Astros World Series replica giveaway ring. And how this Kazakh musician, whose music is in Kazakh, got this ring? I have no idea. But I saw this and sent it to multiple people that worked for the Houston Astros last night, and they got a kick out of it. So this is great. It is a super duper ugly.
So wait a minute. You knew about this musician before this video and just happened to see him show off his Astros bling?
So his music came across my feed a couple days ago, and I like marked it down. I like bookmarked it on the gram. And then I went back to his page to like listen to some more sounds, and I'm like scrolling through. And then one of them, the video starts with him putting the Astros ring at the camera.
Yeah. 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 No, that, nope. I have no, no pushback. That is super ugly. That is, I don't
this
even really know how now I'm excited
a Yankees
to go.
Hat. You know,
No.
This is different.
I'm blown away. I'm blown away. That is really something. Thank you for sharing. I look forward to checking out this music here in as soon as we're done, which we are. We are done. Enjoy the baseball this weekend. Got a couple interesting division matchups, a couple four-game series. Will we have another mop? Ooh, another mop on deck potentially. But we will recap as always when we return on Monday. But until then, thank you all for listening. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing. You can email us at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. We'll talk to you all next week.